blood and dung and rot. Below me sits a battlefield. A killing field, actually, for no battle rages here. Everyone's dead. Moonlight glints off the armor of fallen men. This is what I saw earlier from the rise. It's a strange battlefield, unlike any I've encountered. No one moans or pleads for aid. Barbarians from the borderlands lay beside martial soldiers. I spot what looks like a tribal trader, and beside him, smaller bodies, his family. What is this place? Why would a tribesman battle against marshals and barbarians out in the middle of nowhere?
Elias.
I practically leap from my skin at the sound of my name spoken in such silence, and my dagger is at the throat of the speaker before I can think. He is a barbarian boy, no more than 13. His face is painted with blue woad, and his body is dark with the geometric tattoos unique to his people. Even in the light of the half moon, I know him. I'd know him anywhere. He is my first kill. My eyes drop to the gaping wound in his stomach, a wound I put there 9 years ago, a wound he doesn't seem to notice. I drop my arm and back away.
Impossible.
The boy's dead, which means that all this, the battlefield, the smell, the wastes, must be a nightmare. I pinch my arm to wake myself up. The boy tilts his head. I pinch myself again. I take my dagger and cut my hand with it. Blood drips to the ground. The boy doesn't budge. I can't wake up. Courage to face their darkest fears.
My mother screamed and tore at her hair for 3 days after I died.
My first kill says.
She didn't speak again for 5 years.
He talks quietly in the just-deepened voice of a teenaged boy.
I was her only child,
he adds, as if in explanation. I'm sorry. The boy shrugs and walks away, gesturing for me to follow him onto the battlefield. I don't want to go, but he clamps a chill hand on my arm and pulls me behind him with surprising force. As we wind through the first of the bodies, I look down. A sick feeling seeps through me. I recognize these faces. I killed every one of these people. As I pass them, their voices murmur secrets in my head.
My wife was pregnant.
I was sure I'd kill you first.
My father swore revenge, but died before taking it.
I clap my hands over my ears, but the boy sees, and his clammy fingers pull mine away from my head with inexorable force.
Come,
he says.
There are more.
I shake my head. I know exactly how many people I've killed, when they died, how, where. There are far more than 21 men on this battlefield. I can't have killed them all. But we keep walking, and now there are faces I don't know. And it's a kind of relief, because these faces must be someone else's sins, someone else's darkness.
Your kills,
the boy interrupts my thoughts.
They're all yours. The past, the future, all here. All by your hand.
My hands sweat, and I feel lightheaded. There are scores of people on this battlefield, well over 500. How could I be responsible for the deaths of so many? I look down. There's a lanky, fair-haired mask on my left, and my stomach sinks because I know this mask. Demetrius. No! I bend down to shake him.
Demetrius! Wake up! Get up!
He can't hear you,
my first kill says.
He's gone.
Beside Demetrius lies Leander, blood staining his halo of curly hair, trickling down his crooked nose and off his chin. And a few feet away, Ennis, another member of Helene's battle platoon. Further ahead, I spot a mane of white hair, a powerful body. Grandfather? No! No! There isn't another word for what I'm seeing, because something so terrible shouldn't be allowed to exist. I bend next to another body. The gold-eyed slave girl I've only just met. A raw red line cuts across her throat. Her hair is a mess, snaking out every which way. Her eyes are open, their brilliant gold faded to the color of a dead sun. I think of her intoxicating smell, like fruits and sugar and warmth. I turn on my first kill. These are my friends, my family, people I know. I wouldn't hurt them.
Your kills,
the boy insists, and the terror inside me grows at the sureness with which he speaks. Is this what I will be? A mass murderer? Wake up, Elias! Wake up! But I cannot wake, because I'm not asleep. The augurs have somehow brought my nightmare to life, unrolled it before my eyes. How do I make it stop? I have to make it stop!
It's already done,
the boy says.
This is your destiny. It is written.
No!
I push past him. The battlefield has to end eventually. I'll get by it, keep going through the desert, get out of here. But when I reach the edge of the carnage, the ground lurches and the battlefield stretches out ahead of me again in its entirety. Beyond the battlefield, the landscape has changed. I'm still moving east through the desert.
You can keep walking.
The disembodied whisper of my first kill brushes across my ear, and I start violently.
You may even reach the mountains, but until you conquer your fear, the dead will remain with you.
This is an illusion, Elias. Augur sorcery. Keep walking until you find your way out. I force myself toward the shadow of the Seren Range, but every time I reach the end of the battlefield, I feel the lurch and see the body spread out before me yet again. Every time it happens, it gets harder to ignore the carnage at my feet. My pace slows, and I struggle to stumble on. I pass by the same people over and over until their faces are burned into my memory. The sky lightens and dawn breaks. Second day, I think. Go east, Elias. The battlefield grows hot and fetid. Clouds of flies and scavengers descend. I shout and attack them with my dagger, but I can't keep them away. I want to die of thirst or hunger, but I feel neither in this place. I count 539 bodies. I won't kill so many, I tell myself. I won't. An insidious voice in my head chuckles when I try to convince myself of this. You're a mask, the voice says. Of course you'll kill so many. You'll kill more. I run from the thought, willing with my entire mind to break free of the battlefield. But I cannot. The sky darkens. The moon rises. I cannot leave. Daylight again. It's the third day. The thought appears in my head, but I hardly know what it means. I was supposed to do something by now. Be somewhere. I look to my right at the mountains. There. I'm supposed to go there. I force my body to turn. Sometimes I talk to those I've killed. In my head, I hear them whisper back. Not accusations, but their hopes, their wants. I wish they would curse me instead. It's worse, somehow, to hear all that would have been had I not killed them. East. Elias, go east. It's the only logical thing I can think. But sometimes, lost in the horror of my future, I forget about going east. Instead, I wander from body to body, begging those I've killed for forgiveness. Darkness. Daylight. The fourth day. And soon after, the fifth. But why am I counting the days? The days don't matter. I'm in hell. A hell I've made myself because I am evil. As evil as my mother. As evil as any mask who spends a lifetime relishing the blood and tears of his victims. To the mountains, Elias. A faint voice whispers in my head. The last shred of sanity I have. To the mountains. My feet bleed and my face cracks from the wind. The sky is below me. The ground above. Old memories flit through my head. Mamie Reeler teaching me to write my tribal name. The pain of a centurion's whip tearing into my back that first time. Sitting with Helene in the wilds of the north, watching as the sky swirled with impossible ribbons of light. I trip over a body and crash to the ground. The impact shakes something loose in my mind. Mountains. East. Trial. This is a trial. Thinking those words is like pulling myself from a pool of quicksand. This is a trial, and I must survive it. Most of the people on the battlefield aren't dead yet. I just saw them. This is a test of my mettle, my strength, which means there must be something specific I'm supposed to do to get out of here.
Until you conquer your fear, the dead will remain with you.
I hear a sound. The first sound I've heard in days, it feels like. There, shimmering like a mirage at the edge of the battlefield, is a figure. My first kill again. I stagger toward him, but fall to my knees when I'm just a few feet away. Because it is not my first kill. It's Helene, and she is covered in blood and scratches, her silver hair tangled as she gazes at me with empty eyes.
No, I rasp. Not Helene, not Helene, not Helene.
I chant it like a madman with only two words left in his mind. Helene's ghost comes closer.
Elias.
Skies, her voice, cracked and haunted. So real.
Elias, it's me. It's Helene.
Helene, on my nightmare battlefield. Helene, another victim. No, I will not kill my oldest, best friend. This is a fact, not a wish. I will not kill her. I realize in that moment that I cannot be afraid of something if there's no chance it could ever occur. The knowledge releases me, finally, from the fear that has consumed me for days.
I won't kill you, I say. I swear it. By blood and by bone, I swear it. And I won't kill any of the others either. I won't.
The battlefield fades. The smell fades. The dead fade. As if they had never been real. As if they had only ever been in my mind. Ahead, close enough to touch, sit the mountains I've been staggering toward for 5 days, their rocky trails curving and swooping like tribal calligraphy.
Elias?
Helene's ghost is still here. For a moment, I don't understand. She reaches for my face, and I flinch from her, expecting the cold caress of a spirit. But her skin is warm.
Helene?
Then she's pulling me close, cradling my head, whispering that I'm alive, that she is alive, that we are both all right, that she's found me. I wrap my arms around her waist and bury my face in her stomach. And for the first time in 9 years, I start to cry.
We only have 2 days to get back.
These are the first words Hel spoken since she half-dragged me out of the foothills and into a mountain cave. I say nothing. I'm not ready for words yet. A fox roasts over a fire, and my mouth waters at the smell. Night has fallen, and outside the cave, thunder reverberates. Black clouds roll out from the wastes, and the heavens break open, rain cascading through lightning-edged cracks in the sky.
I saw you around noon.
She adds a few more branches to the fire.
But it took me a couple of hours to come down the mountain to you. Thought you were an animal at first. Then the sun hit your mask.
She stares out at the sheeting rain.
You looked bad.
How did you know I wasn't Marcus?
I croak. My throat is dry, and I take another sip of water from the reed canteen she's made.
Or Zack.
I can tell the difference between you and a couple of reptiles. Besides, Marcus fears water. The augurs wouldn't leave him in a desert. And Zack hates tight spaces, so he's probably underground somewhere. Here, eat.
I eat slowly, watching Helene all the while. Her usually sleek hair is matted, its silver sheen faded. She's covered in scratches and dried blood.
What did you see, Elias? You were coming for the mountains, but you kept falling, clawing at the air. You talked about killing me.
I shake my head. The trial's not over, and I have to forget what I saw if I want to survive the rest of it.
Where did they leave you?
I ask. She wraps her arms around herself and hunches down, her eyes barely visible.
Northwest, in the mountains, in a spire vulture's nest.
I put down my fox. Spire vultures are massive birds with 5-inch talons and wingspans that clear 20 feet. Their eggs are the size of a man's head. Their hatchlings, notoriously bloodthirsty. But worst of all for Helene, the vultures build their nests above the clouds, atop the most unassailable peaks. She doesn't have to explain the catch in her voice. She used to shake for hours after the Commandant made her scale the cliffs. The augurs know all this, of course. They've picked it from her mind the way a thief picks a plum off a tree.
How did you get down?
Luck. The mother vulture was gone, and the hatchlings were just breaking through their shells. But they were dangerous enough, even half-hatched.
She pulls up her shirt to expose the pale, taut skin of her stomach, marred by a tangle of gouges.
I jumped over the side of the nest and landed on a ledge 10 feet down. I didn't realize how high I was. But that wasn't the worst of it. I kept seeing.
She stops, and I realized that the augurs must have forced her to face some foul hallucination, something equal to my nightmare battlefield. What darkness had she borne, thousands of feet up, with nothing between her and death but a few inches of rock?
The augurs are sick, I say. I can't believe they'd...
They're doing what they have to, Elias. They're making us face our fears. They need to find the strongest, remember? The bravest. We have to trust them.
She closes her eyes, shivering. I cross the space between us and put my hands on her arms to still her. When she lifts her lashes, I realize I can feel the heat of her body, that mere inches separate our faces. She has beautiful lips, I notice distractedly. The top one fuller than the bottom. I meet her gaze for one intimate, infinite moment. She leans toward me, those lips parting. A violent throb of desire tugs at me, followed by a frantic alarm bell.
Bad idea. Terrible idea. She's your best friend. Stop.
I drop my arms and back away hastily, trying not to notice the flush on her neck. Helene's eyes flash. Anger or embarrassment, I can't tell.
Anyway,
she says. I got down last night and figured I'd take the rim trail to Walker's Gap. Fastest way back. There's a guard station at the other end. We can get a boat to cross the river and supplies. Clothes and boots, at least.
She gestures to her ragged, blood-stained fatigues.
Not that I'm complaining.
She looks up at me, a question in her eyes.
They left you in the wastes, but...
But you don't fear the desert. You grew up there. No use thinking about it, I say. After that, we are silent, and when the fire burns down, Aline tells me she's turning in. But though she rolls over into a pile of leaves, I know sleep won't come to her. She's still clinging to the side of her mountain, just like I'm still wandering lost in my battlefield. Aline and I are bleary-eyed and exhausted the next morning, but we start out well before dawn. We need to reach Walker's Gap today if we want to get back to Blackcliff by sunset tomorrow. We don't speak. We don't have to. Traveling with Aline is like pulling on a favorite shirt. We spent all of our time as fivers together, and we fall instinctively back into the pattern of those days, with me taking point and Aline the rear guard. The storm rolls away north to reveal a blue sky and a land clean and glistening. But the crisp beauty conceals fallen trees and washed-out trails, hillsides treacherous with mud and debris. There's an unmistakable tension in the air. Just like before, I have the sense that something lies in wait, something unknown. Aline and I don't stop to rest. Our eyes are peeled for bears, lynxes, wayward hunters, any creature that might call the mountains home. In the afternoon, we climb the rise that leads to the gap, a 15-mile-long river of forest amid the blue-speckled peaks of the Serran Range. The gap appears almost gentle, carpeted with trees, rolling hills, and the occasional gold burst of a wildflower meadow. Aline and I exchange a glance. We both feel it. Whatever's coming, it's going to be soon. As we move into the forest, the sense of danger increases, and I catch sight of a furtive movement at the edge of my vision. Aline looks back at me. She's seen it too. We alter our route frequently and stay off the trails, which slows our pace but makes an ambush more difficult. As dusk approaches, we haven't made it out of the pass and are forced to move back to the trail so we can pick our way forward by moonlight. The sun has just set when the forest falls silent. I shout Aline a warning and have barely enough time to bring my knife up before a dark shape hurtles out of the trees. I don't know what I'm expecting. An army of those I killed coming for revenge. A nightmare creature conjured by the augurs. Something that will strike fear into my very bones. Something to test my courage. I don't expect the mask. I don't expect the cold, flat eyes of Zack glaring out at me. Behind me, Aline screams, and I hear the crash of two bodies hitting the ground. I turn to see Marcus attacking her. Her face is frozen in terror at the sight of him, and she makes no move to defend herself as he pins down her arms, laughing like he did when he kissed her. Aline! At my shout, she snaps out of her daze and strikes out at Marcus, twisting away from him. Then Zack is on me, raining blows down on my head, my neck. He fights recklessly, almost frenziedly, and I easily evade his assault. I come around behind him, sweeping my dagger in an arc. He spins back to dodge the attack and lunges at me, teeth bared like a dog's. I duck beneath his arm and sink my dagger into his side. Hot blood sprays across my hand. I wrench the dagger out, and Zack groans and staggers back. Hand on his side, he stumbles into the trees, shouting for his twin. Marcus, serpent that he is, darts into the forest after Zack. Blood shines on Marcus's thigh, and I feel a burst of satisfaction. Hell marked him. I give chase, the battle rage rising, blinding me to anything else. Distantly, Helene calls my name. Ahead of me, the snake's shadow joins with Zack's, and they barrel ahead, unaware of how close I am.
10 burning hells, Zack! Marcus says. The Commandant told us to finish them off before they left the gap, and you go running into the woods like a scared little girl. He stabbed me, all right?
Zack's voice is breathless.
And she didn't tell us we'd be dealing with both of them at once, did she?
Elias!
Helene's shout barely registers. Marcus and Zack's conversation leaves me dumbstruck. It's no surprise that my mother's in league with the snake and toad. What I don't understand is how she knew that Hel and I would be coming through the gap.
We have to finish them!
Marcus's shadow turns, and I bring my dagger up. Then Zack grabs him.
We have to get out of here, he says, or we won't make it back on time. Leave them. Come on.
Part of me wants to chase after Marcus and Zack and take the answers to my questions out of their hides. But Helene cries out again, her voice faint. She might be hurt. When I get back to the clearing, Hel is slumped on the ground, her head tilted to the side. One arm is splayed out uselessly, while she paws at her shoulder with the other, trying to staunch the sluggish pulse of blood draining out of her. I close the distance between us in 2 strides, tearing off what remains of my shirt, wadding it and pressing down on the wound. She bucks her head, her knotted blonde hair whipping at her back as she cries out, a keening, animal wail.
It's all right, Hel, I say.
My hands shake, and a voice in my head screams that it's not all right, that my best friend is going to die. I keep talking.
You're going to be fine. I'm going to fix you right up.
I grab the canteen. I need to clean the wound and bind it.
Talk to me. Tell me what happened.
Surprised me. Couldn't move. I saw him on the mountain. He and I.
She shudders, and I understand now. In the desert, I saw images of war and death. Helene saw Marcus.
His hands. Everywhere.
She squeezes her eyes shut and draws her legs up protectively.
I'll kill him,
I think calmly, making the decision as easily as I choose my boots in the morning.
If she dies, so will he.
Can't let them win. If they win...
Helene's words spill from her mouth.
Fight, Elias. You have to fight. You have to win.
I cut open her shirt with my dagger, jolted for a moment by the delicacy of her skin. Dark has settled in, and I can barely see the wound, but I can feel the warmth of the blood as it oozes into my hand. Helene grabs my arm with her good hand as I pour water over the injury. I bind her up using what's left of my shirt and some strips from her fatigues. After a few moments, her hand goes slack. She's fallen unconscious. My body aches in exhaustion, but I begin pulling vines down from the trees to make a sling. Hel can't walk, so I'll have to carry her to Blackcliff. As I work, my mind whirls. The Farrars ambushed us on the Commandant's orders. No wonder she couldn't contain her smugness before the trials began. She was planning this attack. But how did she learn where we'd be? It wouldn't take a genius, I suppose. If she knew the augurs would leave me in the Great Wastes and Helene in Spire Vulture territory, she would also know the only way for us to get back to Serra was through the gap. But if she told Marcus and Zack, then that means they cheated and sabotaged us, which the augurs pointedly forbade. The augurs must know what happened. Why haven't they done anything about it? When the sling is finished, I carefully load Helene into it. Her skin is blanched bone white, and she shakes with cold. She feels light. Too light. Again, the augurs have preyed on the unexpected fear, the one I didn't realize I had. Helene is dying. I didn't know how terrifying it would be because she's never come so close to it before. My doubts crowd in. I won't make it back to Blackcliff by sunset. The physician won't be able to save her. She'll die before I get to the school. Stop, Elias. Move. After years of the Commandant's forced marches through the desert, carrying Helene is no burden. Though it's deep night, I move quickly. I still have to hike out of the mountains, get a boat from the river guardhouse, and row to Serra. I've already lost hours making the sling, and Marcus and Zack will be well ahead of me. Even if I don't stop from here until Serra, I'll be hard-pressed to reach the bell tower before sunset. The sky pales, casting the jagged peaks of the mountains around me in shadow. The day is well underway when I emerge from the gap. The Rye River stretches out below, slow and curving like a well-sated python. Barges and boats dot the water, and just beyond the eastern banks sits the city of Serra, its dun-colored walls imposing even from a distance of miles. Smoke taints the air. A column of black rises into the sky, and though I can't see the guardhouse from this spot on the trail, I know with sinking certainty that the Farrars got there before me, that they burned it along with the boathouse attached to it. I sprint down the mountain, but by the time I reach the guardhouse, it's nothing but a stinking, sooty hulk. The attached boathouse is a pile of smoldering logs, and the legionnaires manning it have cleared out, probably under orders from the Farrars. I unlash Helene from my back. The jarring trip down the mountain has reopened her wound. My back is coated in her blood. Helene! I sink to my knees and pat her face softly. Helene! Not even a flick of the eyelids. She is lost inside herself, and the skin around her wound is red and fevered. She's getting an infection. I stare flintily at the guard shack, willing a boat to appear. Any boat. A raft. A dinghy. A bleeding, hollowed-out log. I don't care. Anything. But of course, there's nothing. Sunset is, at most, an hour away. If I don't get us across this river, we're dead. Strangely, it's my mother's voice I hear in my head, cold and pitiless. Nothing is impossible. It's something she said to her students 100 times, when we were exhausted from back-to-back training battles, or we hadn't slept in days. She always demanded more than we thought we had to give. Either find a way to complete the tasks I have set before you, she would tell us, or die in the attempt. Your choice. Exhaustion is temporary. Pain is temporary. But Helene dying because I didn't find a way to get her back on time, that's permanent. I spot a smoking wooden beam half in the water, half out. It will do. I kick, shove, and roll the blasted thing to the river, where it bobs beneath the water, threateningly before floating to the surface. Carefully, I lay Helene on the beam and lash her into place. Then I sling an arm around it and make for the closest boat, as if all the gin of air and sea are on my tail. The river's waters run freely at this time, mostly empty of the barges and canoes that choke it in the morning. I angle toward a Mercator craft bobbing mid-river, its oars at rest. The sailors don't notice me approaching, and when I'm right alongside the rope ladder leading to the boat's deck, I cut hell from the beam. She sinks into the water almost immediately. I grab the slick rope with one hand and Helene with the other, eventually working her body over my shoulder and clambering up the ladder to the deck. A silver-haired marshal with a soldier's build, the captain, I assume, is overseeing a group of plebeians and scholar slaves stacking boxes of cargo. I am Aspirant Elias Vittorius of Blackcliff. I level my voice until it is as flat as the deck I stand on. And I am commandeering this vessel. The man blinks, taking in the sight before him, Two masks, one so covered in blood it appears that she's been tortured, and the other practically naked with a week's worth of beard, wild hair, and a mad look in his eyes. But the merchant has clearly done his time in the martial army, because after only a moment, he nods.
I'm at your disposal, Lord Vittorius.
Get this boat docked in Serra, now! The captain shouts orders at his men, a whip much in evidence. In under a minute, the boat is chugging towards Serra's docks. I look balefully at the sinking sun, willing it to at least slow down. I have no more than a half hour left, and I still have to get through the dock traffic and up to Blackcliff. I'm cutting it close. Too close. Helene moans, and I place her on the deck gently. She is sweating despite the cool river air, and her skin is deathly pale. She opens her eyes for a moment.
Do I look that bad?
She whispers, seeing the expression on my face. Actually, it's an improvement. The filthy woodswoman thing suits you. She smiles, a rare, sweet smile, but it fades quickly.
Elias, you can't let me die. If I die, then you...
Don't talk, Hel. Rest.
Can't die. August said... He said if I lived, then...
Shh! Her eyes flutter closed, and impatiently, I eye Serra's docks, still a half mile away and crowded with sailors, soldiers, horses, and wagons. I want to urge the boat faster, but the slaves are already rowing furiously, the captain's whip at their backs. Before the boat docks, the captain lowers the gangplank, hails a legionnaire patrolling nearby, and relieves him of his horse. For once, I'm thankful for the severity of martial discipline.
Luck to you, Lord Vittorius,
the captain says. I thank him and load Hel onto the waiting horse. She sags forward, but I don't have time to adjust her. I vault onto the beast and put heel to flank, my eyes on the sun hovering just above the horizon. The city passes in a blur of gaping plebeians, muttering orcs, and a riot of merchants and their stalls. I race past all of them, down Serra's main thoroughfare, through the dwindling crowds of Execution Square, and up the cobbled streets of the Illustrian Quarter. The horse surges on recklessly, and I'm too crazed to even feel guilty when I knock over a peddler and his cart. Helene's head bobs back and forth like a slack marionette's.
Hang on, Helene, I whisper. Almost there.
We enter an Illustrian market, scattering slaves in our wake before turning a corner. Blackcliff looms before us as suddenly as if it has sprung fully formed from the earth. The faces of the gate guards blur as we gallop past them. The sun sinks lower.
Not yet, I tell it. Not yet. Come on!
I dig my heels in deeper.
Faster!
Then we are across the training field, up the hill, and inside the central courtyard. The bell tower rises in front of me, a few precious yards away. I jerk the horse to a halt and leap off it. The commandant stands at the base of the tower, her face stiff. From anger or nerves, I can't tell. Beside her, Kane waits with two other augurs, both women. They look at me with mute interest, as if I am a mildly entertaining side act at a circus. A scream tears through the air. The courtyard is lined with hundreds of people, students, centurions, and families, including Helene's. Her mother falls to her knees, hysterical at the sight of her blood-covered daughter. Hel's sisters, Hannah and Livia, drop beside her as Pater Aquilus remains stone-faced. Next to him, Grandfather stands in full battle dress. He looks like a bull about to charge, and his grey eyes blaze with pride. I pull Helene into my arms and stride to the bell tower. It's never seemed so long, this courtyard, not even when I've run 100 sprints across it in the dead of summer. My body drags. All I want is to collapse onto the ground and sleep for a week. But I take those last few steps, laying Helene down against the tower and reaching out a hand to touch the stone. A moment after my skin meets the rock, the sunset drums boom out. The crowd erupts. I'm not sure who starts the cheer. Varys, Dex, maybe even Grandfather. The whole square echoes with it. They must hear it down in the city.
Veturius! 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 Get the physician!
I roar at a nearby cadet, who cheers with all the others. His hands freeze mid-clap, and he gapes at me.
Now! Move!
Helene, I whisper.
Hold on.
She's as waxen as a doll. I put a hand against her cold cheek, rubbing a circle over the skin with my thumb. She doesn't move. She doesn't draw breath. And when I put my fingers to her throat, to where her pulse should be, I feel nothing.
Chapter 17 Lyra. Sunna and Mazin disappear up an interior staircase as Keenan walks me out of the basement. I expect him to beg off as quickly as possible. Instead, he beckons me to follow him to a weed-choked back street nearby. The street is empty but for a band of urchins crouching over some small treasure, and they scatter at our approach. I sidle a glance at the red-haired fighter, to find his attention fixed on me with an intensity that sends an unexpected flutter through my chest.
They've been hurting you.
I'm fine, I say. I won't let him think I'm weak. I'm on thin ice as it is. Darin's all that matters. The rest is just... I shrug. Keenan cocks his head and brushes a thumb across the now faint bruises on my neck. Then he takes my wrist and turns it over to reveal the angry welts the Commandant left there. His hands are slow and gentle as candle flame, and the warmth in my chest spreads up through my collarbone and down to my fingertips. My pulse skitters, and I shake his hand away, unnerved at my own reaction.
Was it all the Commandant?
It's nothing to worry about, I say more sharply than I intend. His eyes go cold at the bite in my voice, and I soften. I can do this, all right? It's Darin's life at stake here. I just wish I knew... if he is nearby, if he is all right, if he is in pain.
Darin's still in Sarah. I heard the spy who gave the report.
Keenan walks me further down the street.
But he's not. Well, they've been at him.
A punch to the stomach would have been gentler. I don't have to ask who they are. I already know. Interrogators. Masks.
Look, Keenan says. You don't know the first thing about spying. That's clear. Here are some basics. Gossip with the other slaves. You'll be surprised at what you learn.
Keep your hands busy. Sewing, scrubbing, fetching.
The busier you are, the less likely it is that anyone will question your presence, wherever you might be. If you see a chance to get your hands on real information, take it. But always have an exit plan. The cloak you're wearing is good. It helps you blend in. But you walk and act like a free woman. If I noticed it, others will too. Shuffle, hunch, act beaten, act broken.
Why are you trying to help me? I ask.
You didn't want to risk the men to save my brother.
He is suddenly very interested in the mouldering bricks of a nearby building.
My parents are dead too, he says. My whole family, actually. A long time ago now.
He gives me a quick, almost angry glance, and for a second, I see them in his eyes, this lost family, flashes of fiery hair and freckles. Did he have brothers? Sisters? Was he the oldest? The youngest? I want to ask, but his face is shuttered.
I still think the mission is a terrible idea, he says. But that doesn't mean I don't understand why you're doing it. And it doesn't mean I want you to fail.
He touches his fist to his heart and holds out his hand to me.
Death before tyranny, he murmurs. Death before tyranny. I take his hand, aware of every muscle in his fingers. No one has touched me for the past 10 days except to hurt me. How I miss being touched. Nan stroking my hair, Darin arm wrestling me and pretending to lose, Pop squeezing my shoulder goodnight. I don't want Keenan to let go. As if he understands, he holds on a moment longer. But then he turns and walks away, leaving me alone on an empty street with fingers still tingling. After delivering the Commandant's first letter to the courier's office, I head to the smoke-choked streets near the river docks. Serian summers are always blistering, but the heat in the weapons quarter takes on an animal assurance. The district is a hive of movement and sound, busier on a regular day than most markets are on festival days. Sparks fly from hammers as big as my head, forge fires glow a red deeper than blood, and cottony plumes of steam erupt every few feet from freshly quenched swords. Blacksmiths shout orders as apprentices jostle to follow them. And above it all, the strain and pump of hundreds of bellows, creaking like a fleet of ships in a storm. Within seconds of entering the district, I am stopped by a platoon of legionnaires demanding to know my business. I offer them the Commandant's remaining letter, only to find myself arguing with them over its authenticity for 10 minutes. Finally, grudgingly, they send me on my way. It makes me wonder yet again how Darin managed to get into the district, not just once, but day after day. They've been at him, Keenan said. How long can Darin hold out against his torturers? Longer than me, certainly. When Darin was 15, he fell from a tree while trying to draw scholars working a martial orchard. He arrived home with bone jutting out of his wrist, and I screamed and nearly fainted at the sight. It's all right, he'd said to me. Pop will set it, find him, and then go back for my sketchbook. I dropped it, and I don't want someone to take it. My brother has mother's iron will. If anyone can survive a martial interrogation, it's him. As I walk, I feel a tug on my skirt and glance down, expecting to find it caught beneath someone's boot. Instead, I catch a glimpse of a slit-eyed shadow slipping quickly across the cobbles. A tingle runs up my spine at the sight, and I hear a low, cruel cackle. My skin prickles. That laugh was directed at me. I'm certain of it. Unsettled, I quicken my pace, eventually persuading an elderly plebeian man to direct me to Tullamon's Forge. I find it just off the main street, marked only by an ornate iron T hammered into the door. Unlike the other forges, this one is utterly silent. I knock, but no one answers. Now what? Do I open the door and risk angering the smith by barging in? Or do I go back to the Commandant without a response when she specifically demanded one? It's not a difficult choice. The front door opens to an antechamber. A dust-coated counter splits the room, backed by dozens of glass display cases and another, narrower door. The forge itself sits in a larger room to my right, cold and empty, its bellows still. A hammer lies on an anvil, but the other tools hang neatly from pegs on the walls. Something strikes me about the room. It reminds me of another I've seen, but I can't place it. Light filters in weakly through a bank of high windows, illuminating the dust I kicked up when entering. The place has an abandoned feel to it, and I feel my frustration building. How am I supposed to take back a response if the smith isn't here? Sunlight glints off the row of glass cases, and my gaze is drawn to the weapons within. They are gracefully wrought, each one worked with the same intricate, almost obsessive detail, from hilt to crossbar to minutely etched blade. Intrigued by their beauty, I move closer. The blades remind me of something, as the whole shop does. Something important. Something I should be able to put my finger on. And then I understand. The Commandant's letter falls from my suddenly numb hand. And I know. Darin drew these weapons. He drew this forge. He drew that hammer and that anvil. I spent so much time trying to figure out how to save my brother that I'd nearly forgotten the drawings that had gotten him into trouble in the first place. And here is their source, before my eyes.
Something the matter, girl?
A martial man comes through the narrow back door, looking more like a river pirate than a blacksmith. His head is shaved, and he drips with piercings, 6 through each ear, 1 in his nose, his eyebrows, his lips. Multicolored tattoos of 8 pointed stars, lush leafed vines, a hammer, an anvil, a bird, a woman's eyes. Scales run from his wrists up his arms and into a black leather jerkin. He can't be more than 15 years older than me. Like most marshals, he's tall and muscled, but lanky, without the brawn I'd expect of a blacksmith. Is this the man Darin was spying on?
Who are you?
I'm so thrown off that I forget he's a marshal. The man lifts his eyebrows as if to say, me? Who in the 10 hells are you?
This is my shop, he says. I'm Spiro Tullaman.
Of course he is. Liar, you idiot. I scramble for the note from the Commandant, hoping the Smith thinks my comment is the result of being a dim-witted scholar rat. He reads the note, but says nothing. She requested a response, sir.
Not interested.
He looks up.
Tell her I'm not interested.
Then he returns to the back room. I stare after Tullaman uncertainly. Does he know my brother was taken to prison for spying on his shop? Has the Smith seen what Darin drew? Is his shop always abandoned? Is that how Darin got so close? I'm still trying to piece it all together when an unsettling feeling creeps up my neck, like the greedy touch of a ghost's fingers. Liar. A clump of shadows is gathered at the foot of the door, black as spilled ink. The shadows take shape, eyes glinting, and I begin to sweat. Why here? Why now? How can creatures of my own mind not be controllable by me? Why can I not will them away? Liar. The shadows rise, morphing into a man-like shape. They take on form and colour, and the voice is as familiar and true as if my brother is standing in front of me. Why did you leave me, liar? Darin, I forget that this is a hallucination, that I'm in a martial forge with a murderous-looking blacksmith yards away. The simulacrum tilts its head, just like Darin used to.
They're hurting me, liar.
It's not Darin. My mind is slipping. This is guilt, fear. The voice changes, twisting and layering as if there are 3 Darins all talking at once. The light in the fake Darin's eyes goes out as quickly as a sun in a storm, and his irises darken into black pits as if his entire body is filled with shadow. I won't survive it, liar. It hurts. The simulacrum's hand shoots out to grab my arm, and a bone-deep cold jolts through me. I scream before I can stop myself, and a second later, the creature's hand drops away. I feel a presence behind me, and turn to find Spiro Tullaman, wielding the most beautiful sim I've ever seen. He pushes me casually to the side, holding the sim to the simulacrum. As if he can see the creatures, as if he can hear them.
Begone, he says.
The simulacrum swells, titters, and then falls into a pile of laughing shadows, their cackles falling against my ears like slivers of ice.
We have the boy now. Our brother's gnaw at his soul. Soon he will be mad and ripe. Then we shall feast.
Spiro brings the sim down. The shadows scream, and the sound is like nails on wood. They squeeze under the door, a mass of rats escaping a flood. Seconds later, they're gone. You can see them, I say. I thought they were all in my head. I thought I was going mad.
They're called ghouls, Telemann says.
But 17 years of scholar pragmatism protest the existence of creatures that are supposed to be nothing but legend. But ghouls aren't real.
They are as real as you or I. They left our world for a time, but they've returned. Not everyone can see them. They feed off sorrow and sadness and the stink of blood.
He looks around his forge.
They like this place.
His pale green eyes meet mine, careful and wary.
I've changed my mind. Tell the Commandant I'll consider her request. Tell her to send me some specs. Tell her to send them with you.
My mind whirls with questions when I leave the smithy. Why did Darin draw Tullerman's shop? How did he get in? Why can Tullerman see the ghouls? Did he see the shadow Darin too? Is Darin dying? If ghouls are real, then are Jin real too? When I arrive back at Blackcliff, I attack my tasks with a single-minded focus, losing myself in the polishing of floors and scrubbing of baths, so that I might escape the cyclone of thoughts in my head. By late evening, the Commandant still has not returned. I head to the kitchen, smelling of polish, my head aching with the indecipherable echo of Blackcliff's drums, which have been pounding all day. Izzy risks a glance in my direction while she folds a stack of towels. When I smile, she offers a tentative twitch of her lips in return. Cook wipes down the counters for the night, ignoring me as usual. I think back to Keenan's advice, to gossip, to keep myself busy. Quietly, I take up a basket of mending and sit at the work table. As I watch Cook and Izzy, I suddenly wonder if they are related. They tilt their heads in the same way. They are both small and fair-haired. And there's a quiet companionship between them that makes my heart ache for Nan. Eventually, Cook turns in for the night, and silence fills the kitchen. Somewhere in the city, my brother suffers in a martial prison. You have to get information, Liar. You have to get the Resistance something. Get Izzy to talk. The Legionnaires were in an uproar outside, I say without looking up from my mending. Izzy makes a polite sound. And the students, too. I wonder why. When she doesn't respond, I shift my sitting position, and she glances over her shoulder at me. It's the trials. She stops her folding for a moment. The Farah brothers came back this morning. Aquila and Veturius barely made it on time. They'd have been killed if they'd showed up even seconds later. This is the most she'd said to me at once, and I have to remind myself not to stare. How do you know all this? I ask. The entire school's talking about it. Izzy lowers her voice, and I inch closer. Even the slaves. Not much else to talk about around here. Unless you want to sit around comparing bruises. I chuckle, and it feels strange, almost wrong, like making a joke at a funeral. But Izzy smiles, and I don't feel as bad. The drums start up again, and though Izzy doesn't halt her work, I can tell she's listening. You understand the drums. They mostly give orders. Blue platoon, report for watch. All cadets to the armory, that sort of thing. Right now, they're ordering a sweep of the eastern tunnels. She looks down at the neat stack of towels. A strand of blonde hair falls into her face, making her appear especially young. When you've been here for a while, you'll learn to understand them. As I take in that disturbing fact, the front door slams shut. Izzy and I both jump.
Slave girl!
It's the Commandant.
Upstairs.
Izzy and I exchange a glance, and I'm surprised to find my heart thudding uncomfortably fast. A slow dread sinks into my bones with every step up the stairs. I don't know why. The Commandant calls me up every evening to take her clothes for washing and braid her hair for the night. It's no different today, liar. When I enter her room, she stands at her dresser, idly passing a dagger through a candle flame.
Did you bring back an answer from the swordsmith?
I relay Talamon's reply, and the Commandant turns to regard me with cool interest. It's the most emotion I've seen from her.
Spiro hasn't accepted a new commission in years. He must have taken a liking to you.
The way she says it makes my skin crawl. She tests the edge of her knife on her forefinger, then wipes away the drop of blood that beads there.
Why did you open it?
Sir?
The letter, she says. You opened it. Why?
She stands before me, and if running would have done me any good, I'd have been out the door in a heartbeat. I twist the cloth off my shirt in my hands. The Commandant tilts her head, awaiting my answer as if genuinely curious, as if I might somehow say something that will satisfy her. It was an accident. My hand slipped and broke the seal.
You can't read, she says. So I don't see why you would bother to open it purposefully. Unless you're a spy planning to give over my secrets to the resistance.
Her mouth twists into what might be a smile if it didn't appear so joyless. How did she find out about the letter? I think of the scrape I heard in the hallway after I left her rooms this morning. Did she see me tamper with it? Had the courier's office noticed a flaw in the seal? It doesn't matter. I think of Izzy's warning when I first got here. The Commandant sees things, knows things she shouldn't. A knock comes at the door, and on the Commandant's command, two legionnaires enter and salute.
Hold her down, the Commandant says.
The legionnaires grab me, and the presence of the Commandant's knife is suddenly sickeningly clear.
No, please, no!
Silence.
She draws the word out, softly, like the name of a lover. The soldiers pin me to a chair, their armored hands as heavy as manacles around my arms, their knees coming down on my feet. Their faces give nothing away.
Normally, I'd take an eye for such insolence, the Commandant muses. Or a hand. But I don't think Spiro Talamon will be so interested in you if you're marred. You're lucky I want a Talamon blade, girl. You're lucky. He wants a taste of you.
Her eyes fall on my chest, on the smooth skin above my heart.
Please, I say.
It was a mistake. She leans in close, her lips inches from mine, those dead eyes lit for just a moment with terrifying fury.
Stupid girl, she whispers. Haven't you learned? I don't abide mistakes.
She shoves a gag in my mouth, and then the knife is burning, searing, carving a path through my skin. She works slowly, so slowly. The smell of singed flesh fills my nostrils, and I hear myself begging for mercy, then sobbing, then screaming. Darin, Darin, think of Darin. But I can't think of my brother. Lost in the pain, I can't even remember his face.
Chapter 18. Elias. Helene's not dead. She can't be. She survived initiation, the wilds, border skirmishes, whippings. That she'd die now, in the hands of someone as vile as Marcus, is unthinkable. The part of me that is still a child, The part of me that I didn't know still existed until this moment howls in rage. The crowd in the courtyard pushes forward. Students crane their necks, trying to get a look at Helene. My mother's ice-chiseled face disappears from view. "Wake up, Helene!" I yell at her, ignoring the pressing crowd. "Come on!" She's gone. It was too much for her. For a second that never seems to end, I hold her, numb as the realization sinks in. She's dead. "Out of the way, damn you!" Grandfather's voice seems far away, but a second later, he's beside me. I stare at him, shaken. Only a few days ago, I saw him dead on the nightmare battlefield. But here he is, alive and well. He lays a hand against Helene's throat. "Still alive," he says. "Barely. Clear the way." His simmer's out, and the crowd backs away. "Get the physician. Find a litter. Move!"
"Auger,"
I choke out.
"Where's the auger?"
As if my thoughts summon him, Kane appears. I thrust Helene at Grandfather, struggling not to wrap my hands around the auger's neck for what he's put us through.
"You have the power to heal,"
I say through gritted teeth.
"Save her while she's still alive."
"I understand your anger, Elias. You feel pain, sorrow."
His words fall upon my ears like the incessant caws of a crow.
"Your rules, no cheating."
"Calm, Elias. Don't lose it. Not now." "But the Faraz cheated. They knew we were coming through the gap. They ambushed us."
"The Augur's minds are linked. If one of us aided Marcus and Zack, the rest would know. Your whereabouts were concealed from all others."
"Even my mother?"
Kane pauses for a telling moment.
"Even her."
"You've read her mind?"
Grandfather speaks up from beside me.
"You're absolutely certain she didn't know where Elias was?"
"Reading thoughts isn't like reading a book, General. It requires study."
"Can you read her or not?"
"Caris Veturia walks dark paths. The darkness cloaks her, hiding her from our sight."
"That's a no, then,"
Grandfather says dryly.
"If you can't read her," I say, "how do you know she didn't help Marcus and Zack cheat? Did you read them?"
"We do not feel the need."
"Reconsider."
My temper surges.
"My best friend is dying because those sons of a whore pulled the wool over your eyes."
"Serena,"
Kane says to one of the other augurs,
"stabilize Aquila and isolate the Faraz. No one is to see them."
The auger turns back to me.
"If what you say is true, then the balance is upset, and we must restore it. We will heal her. But if we cannot prove that Marcus and Zacharias cheated, then we must leave Aspirant Aquila to her fate."
I nod tersely, but in my head I'm screaming at Kane.
"You idiot! You stupid, repulsive demon! You're letting those cretins win! You're letting them get away with murder!"
Grandfather, unusually silent, walks with me to the infirmary. When we reach the infirmary doors, they open, and the Commandant emerges.
"Giving your lackeys warning, Caris."
Grandfather towers over his daughter, his lip curling.
"I don't know what you mean." "You're a traitor to your gens, girl,"
Grandfather says, the only man in the Empire brave enough to refer to my mother as a girl.
"Don't think I'll forget it." "You picked your favorite, General."
Mother's eyes slide to me, and I spot a flash of unhinged rage.
"And I've picked mine."
She leaves us at the infirmary door. Grandfather watches her go, and I wish I knew what he was thinking. What does he see when he looks at her? The little girl she was. The soulless creature she is now. Does he know why she became like this? Did he watch it happen?
Don't underestimate her, Elias, he says. She's not used to losing.
Chapter 19 Liar. When I open my eyes, the low roof of my quarters looms over me. I don't remember losing consciousness. Perhaps I'd been out for minutes, perhaps hours. Through the curtain strung across my doorway, I catch a glimpse of a sky that looks as if it's still undecided as to whether it's night or morning. I push myself to my elbows, stifling a moan. The pain is all-consuming, so pervasive it feels as if I've never been without it. I don't look at the wound. I don't need to. I watch the Commandant as she carved it into me, a thick-lined, precise K stretching from my collarbone to the skin over my heart. She's branded me, marked me as her property. It's a scar I'll carry to the grave. Clean it, bandage it, get back to work. Don't give her an excuse to hurt you again. The curtain shifts. Izzy slips in and sits at the end of my pallet, small enough that she doesn't need to stoop to avoid hitting her head. It's nearly dawn. Her hand drifts to her eye patch, but catching herself, she knots her fingers into her shirt. The Legionnaires brought you down last night. It's so ugly. I hate myself for saying it. Weak liar. You're so weak. Mother had a 6-inch scar on her hip from a Legionnaire who nearly got the best of her. Father had lash marks on his back. He never said how he got them. They both wore their scars proudly, proof of their ability to survive. Be strong, like them, liar. Be brave. But I'm not strong. I'm weak, and I'm sick of pretending I'm not. Could be worse. Izzy raises a hand to her missing eye. This was my first punishment. How? When? Skies, there's no delicate way to ask about this. I fall silent. A month after we arrived here, Cook tried to poison the Commandant. Izzy toys with her eye patch. I was 5, I think. It was more than 10 years ago now. The Commandant smelled the poison. Masks are trained in such things. She didn't lay a finger on Cook. Just came at me with a hot poker and made Cook watch. Right before, I remember wishing for someone. My mother, my father. Someone to stop her. Someone to take me away. After, I remember wanting to die. 5 years old. For the first time, it sinks in that Izzy has been a slave nearly her whole life. What I've gone through for 11 days, she has suffered for years. Cook kept me alive after. She's good at remedies. She wanted to bandage you up last night, but, well, you wouldn't let either of us near you. I remember, then, the Legionnaires throwing my numb body into the kitchen. Gentle hands, soft voices. I fought them with whatever I had left, thinking they meant me harm. Our silence is broken by the echo of the dawn drums. A moment later, Cook's raspy voice echoes down the corridor, asking Izzy if I'm up yet. The Commandant wants you to bring her sand from the dunes for a scrub, Izzy says. Then she wants you to take a file to Spiro Tullaman. But you should let Cook tend to you first. No. My vehemence startles Izzy to her feet. I lower my voice. So many years around the Commandant would make me jumpy too. The Commandant will want the scrub for her morning bath. I don't want to be punished for being late. Izzy nods, then offers me a basket for the sand and hurries away. When I stand, my vision swoops. I wrap a scarf around my neck to cover the K and lurch from my room. Every step is pain. Every ounce of weight pulls at the wound,
making me light-headed and nauseous. Unwillingly, my mind flashes back to the single-minded concentration on the Commandant's face as she cut into me. She is a connoisseur of pain, the way others are connoisseurs of wine. She took her time with me, and that made it so much worse. I moved to the back of the house with excruciating slowness. By the time I reach the cliff path that leads down to the dunes, my whole body shakes. Hopelessness steals over me. How can I help Darin if I can't even walk? How can I spy if my every attempt is punished like this? You can't save him because you won't survive the Commandant much longer. My doubts rise insidiously from the soil of my mind like creeping, choking vines. That will be the end of you and your family, crushed from existence like so many others. The trail twists and turns back on itself, treacherous as the shifting dunes. A hot wind blows into my face, forcing tears from my eyes before I can stop them, until I can hardly see where I am going. At the base of the cliffs, I fall to the sand. My sobs echo in this empty place, but I don't care. There is no one to hear me. My life in the Scholars' Quarter was never easy. Sometimes it was horrible, like when my friend Zara was taken, or when Darin and I rose and slept with the ache of hunger in our bellies. Like all scholars, I learned to lower my eyes before the marshals, but at least I never had to bow and scrape before them. At least my life was free of this torment, this waiting always for more pain. I had Nan and Pop who protected me from far more than I ever realized. I had Darin, who loomed so large in my life that I thought him immortal as the stars. Gone now, all of them. Lys, with her laughing eyes, so vivid in my mind that it seems impossible that she's been dead 12 years. My parents, who wanted so badly to free the scholars, but who only managed to get themselves killed. Gone, like everyone else, leaving me here, alone. Shadows emerge from the sand, circling me. Ghouls. They feed off sorrow and sadness and the stink of blood. One of them screams, startling me into dropping the basket. The sound is eerily familiar. Mercy! They mock in a multi-layered, high-pitched voice. Please, have mercy! I clap my hands over my ears, recognizing my own voice in theirs. My pleas to the Commandant. How did they know? How did they hear? The shadows titter and circle. One, braver than the rest, nips at my leg, teeth flashing. A chill pierces my skin and I cry out, stop! The ghouls cackle and pirate my plea. Stop! Stop! If only I had a sim, a knife, something to scare them off, the way Spiro Tullamon did. But I have nothing, so I try instead to stagger away, only to run straight into a wall. At least that's what it feels like. It takes me a moment to realize that it's not a wall, but a person. A tall person, broad-shouldered and muscled like a mountain cat. I flinch back, losing my balance, and two big hands steady me. I look up and freeze when I find myself staring into familiar, pale grey eyes.
Chapter 20. Elias. The morning after the trial, I wake before dawn. Groggy from the sleeping draught, I realize I've been doused with. My face is shaven. I'm clean. And someone's changed me into fresh fatigues. Elias. Cain emerges from the shadows of my room. His face is drawn, as if he's been up all night. He holds up his hand at my instant barrage of questions. Aspirant Aquila is in the very capable hands of Blackcliff's physician, he says. If she's meant to live, she will. The augurs will not interfere, for we found nothing to indicate that the Ferrars cheated. We have declared Marcus the winner of the first trial. He has been given a prize of a dagger, and...
What?
He returned first.
Because he cheated!
The door opens, and Zack limps in. I reach for the blade Grandfather left at my bedside. Before I can fling it at the toad, Kane is between us. I get up and quickly stuff my feet into my boots. I won't be caught lounging on a bed while this filth is within 10 feet of me. Kane steeples his bloodless fingers and examines Zack.
You have something to say.
You should heal her.
Veins stand out in Zack's neck, and he shakes his head like a wet dog ridding itself of water.
Stop it! He says to the auger. Stop trying to get in my head! Just heal her, all right? Feeling guilty, you ass?
I try to shove past Kane, but the auger blocks me with surprising swiftness.
I'm not saying we cheated.
Zack looks quickly at Kane.
I'm saying you should heal her. Here.
Kane's whole body goes still as he fixates on Zack. The air shifts and grows heavy. The auger is reading him. I can feel it.
You and Marcus found each other.
Kane furrows his brow.
You were led to each other. But not by one of the augurs, nor by the commandant.
The auger closes his eyes, as if listening harder, before opening them.
Well,
I ask,
what did you see?
Enough to convince me that the augurs must heal Aspirant Aquila, but not enough to convince me that the Ferrars committed sabotage.
Why can't you just look into Zack's mind like you do everyone else's, and...
Our power is not without its limits. We cannot penetrate the minds of those who have learned to shield themselves.
I give Zack an appraising look. How in the 10 hells did he figure out how to keep the augurs out of his head?
You both have an hour to leave school grounds, Kane says. I'll inform the Commandant that I've dismissed you from your duties for the day. Go for a walk. Go to the market. Go to a whorehouse. I don't care. Don't return to the school until evening. And don't come back to the infirmary. Do you understand?
Zack frowns.
Why do we have to leave?
Because your thoughts, Zacharias, are a pit of agony. And yours, Vittorius, echo with such deafening vengeance that I can hear nothing else. Neither will allow me to do what I must to heal Aspirant Aquila. So you will leave. Now.
Kane moves aside, and reluctantly, Zack and I walk out the door. Zack tries to hurry away from me, but I've got questions that need answering, and I'm not about to let him worm his way out of them. I catch up to him.
How did you figure out where we were? How did the Commandant know?
She has ways.
What ways? What did you show Kane? How did you manage to keep him out of your head at will? Zack!
I pull his shoulder around so he faces me. He throws my hand off, but doesn't walk away.
All that tribal rubbish about djinn and ifrits, ghouls and wraiths. It's not rubbish, Vittorius. It's not myth. The old creatures are real. They're coming for us. Protect her. It's the only thing you're good for.
What do you care about her? Your brother's tormented her for years, and you've never said a word to stop him. Zack regards the sand training fields, empty at this early hour.
You know the worst thing about all this?
He says quietly.
I was so close to leaving him behind forever. So close to being free of him.
It's not what I expect to hear. Ever since we came to Blackcliff, there has been no Marcus without Zack. The younger Ferrar is closer to his brother than Marcus's own shadow. If you want to be free of him,
then why go along with his every whim? Why not stand up to him? We've been together for so long.
Zack shakes his head. His face is unreadable where the mask hasn't yet melded.
I don't know who I am without him.
When he walks to the front gates, I don't follow. I need to clear my head. I make for the eastern watchtower, where I strap myself into a harness and rappel down to the dunes. Sand swirls around me. My thoughts are confused. I trudge along the base of the cliffs, watching the horizon pale as the sun rises. The wind grows stronger, hot and insistent. As I walk, it seems like shapes appear in the sands, figures spinning and dancing, feeding off the wind's ferocity. Whispers ride the air, and I think I hear the piercing staccato of wild laughter.
The old creatures are real. They're coming for us.
Is Zack trying to tell me something about the next trial? Is he saying that my mother is consorting with demons? Is that how she sabotaged me in hell? I tell myself that these thoughts are ridiculous. Believing in the Augur's power is one thing, but Djinn of fire and vengeance, ifrits bound to elements like wind, sea, or sand. Maybe Zack's just cracked from the strain of the first trial. Mamie Rela used to tell stories of the Fae. She was our tribe's Kehani, our tale spinner, and she wove whole worlds with her voice, with the flick of a hand or the tilt of her head. Some of those legends stuck in my head for years. The Nightbringer and his hatred for scholars. The Ifrit's skill at awakening latent magic in humans. Soul-hungry ghouls who feed on pain like vultures on carrion. But those are just stories. The wind carries the haunting sound of sobbing to my ears. At first, I think I'm imagining it, and chide myself for letting Zack's talk of the Fae get to me. But then it gets louder. Ahead of me, at the front of the twisting path that leads up to the Commandant's house, sits a small, crumpled figure. It's the slave girl with the gold eyes, the one Marcus nearly choked to death, the one I saw lifeless on the nightmare battlefield. She holds her head with one hand and bats at the empty air with the other, muttering through her sobs. She staggers, falls to the ground, then rises laboriously. It's clear she's not well, that she needs help. I slow, thinking to turn away. My mind roves back to the battlefield and my first kill's assertion that everyone on that field will die by my hand.
Stay away from her, Elias,
a cautious voice urges.
Have nothing to do with her.
But why stay away? The battlefield was the Augur's vision of my future. Maybe I should show the bastards that I'm going to fight that future, that I won't just accept it. I stood by like a fool once before with this girl. I watched and did nothing as Marcus left bruises all over her. She needed help, and I refused to give it. I won't make the same mistake again. Without any more hesitation, I walk toward her.
Chapter 21 Liar. It's a commandant's son. Baturius. Where did he come from? I push at him violently, then immediately regret doing so. A normal Blackcliff student would beat me for touching him without permission. And this is no student, but an aspirant, and the commandant's spawn. I have to get out of here. I have to get back to the house. But the weakness that has plagued me all morning takes firm hold, and I fall to the sand a few feet away, sweating and nauseous. Infection. I know the signs. I should have let Cook dress the wound last night.
Who are you talking to?
Baturius asks. No one, aspirant, sir. Not everyone can see them, Tullamon had said of the ghouls. It's clear, Baturius can't. You look terrible, he says. Come into the shade. The sand. I have to take it up or she'll... Sit. It's not a request. He picks up my basket and takes my hand, leading me to the shade of the cliffs and setting me down on a small boulder. When I chance a look at him, he's gazing out at the horizon, his mask catching the dawn light, like water catching the sun. Even at a distance of a few feet, everything about him screams violence, from the short black hair to the big hands to the fact that each muscle is honed to deadly perfection. The bandages that encircle his forearms and the scratches that mar his hands and face only make him look more vicious. He has just one weapon, a dagger at his belt. But then he's a mask. He doesn't need weapons because he is one, particularly when faced with a slave who barely comes up to his shoulder. I try to scoot away further, but my body is too heavy. What's your name? You never said. He fills my basket with sand, not looking at me. I think of when the Commandant asked me this question and the blow I received for answering honestly. Slave girl? He is quiet for a moment. Tell me your real name. Though calmly spoken, the words are a command.
Liar.
Liar, he says. What did she do to you?
How strange that a mask can sound so kind, that the deep thrum of his baritone can offer comfort. I could close my eyes and not know I was speaking to a mask at all. But I can't trust his voice. He's her son. If he is showing concern, there is a reason for it, and not one that favors me. Slowly, I push back my scarf. When he sees the K, his eyes go hard behind the mask, and for a moment, sadness and fury burn in his gaze. I'm startled when he speaks again.
May I?
He lifts a hand, and I barely feel it when his fingers brush the skin near my wound.
Your skin's hot. He lifts a basket of sand. The wound is bad. It needs attention.
I know that, I say. Commandant wanted sand, and I didn't have time to... Veturius's face swims for a moment, and I feel strangely weightless. He's close then, close enough for me to feel the heat of his body. The scent of cloves and rain drifts over me. I close my eyes to stop everything from lurching, but it doesn't help. His arms are around me, hard and gentle all at once, and he lifts me up.
Let me go!
My strength peaks, and I shove at his chest. What is he doing? Where is he taking me?
How else do you plan to get back up the cliffs? He asks.
His broad strides carry us easily up the winding switchbacks.
You can barely stand.
Does he actually think I'm stupid enough to accept his help? This is a trick he's plotted with his mother. Some further punishment awaits. I have to escape him. But as he walks, another wave of dizziness hits me, and I clutch his neck until it passes. If I hold on tight enough, he won't be able to throw me to the dunes. Not without getting dragged down himself. My eyes fall on his bandaged arms, and I remember that the first trial ended yesterday. Veturius catches me looking.
Just scratches, he says. Augurs left me in the middle of the great wastes for the first trial. After a few days without water, I started falling down a lot.
They left you in the wastes? I shudder. Everyone's heard of that place. It makes the tribal lands look almost habitable. And you survived? Did they at least warn you?
They like surprises.
Even through my sickness, the impact of what he's said isn't lost on me. If the aspirants don't know what will happen in the trials, how can I possibly find out? Doesn't the Commandant know what you'll be up against?
Why am I asking him so many questions? It's not my place. My head must be addled from the wound. But if my curiosity bothers Veturius, he doesn't say so. She might. Doesn't matter. Even if she knows, she wouldn't tell me. His mother doesn't want him to win. Part of me wonders at their bizarre relationship. But then I remind myself that they're marshals. Marshals are different. Veturius crests the cliff and ducks beneath the clothes fluttering on the line, heading down the slave's corridor. When he carries me into the kitchen and sets me down on a bench beside the work table, Izzy, scrubbing the floor, drops her brush and stares open-mouthed. Cook's glance falls to my wound, and she shakes her head. "Kitchen girl," Cook says. "Take the stand upstairs. If the commandant asks about slave girl, tell her she's taken ill and that I'm tending to her so she can get back to work." Izzy picks up the basket of sand without a sound and disappears. A wave of nausea breaks over me, and I'm forced to drop my head between my legs for a few moments. "Lyra's wound's infected," Veturius says when Izzy leaves. "Do you have bloodroot serum?" If Cook is surprised that the commandant's son is using my given name, she doesn't show it. "Bloodroot's too valuable for the likes of us. I've tanroot and wildwood tea." Veturius frowns and gives Cook the same instructions Pop would have. Wildwood tea 3 times a day, tanroot to clean the wound, and no bandage. He turns to me. "I'll find some bloodroot and bring it to you tomorrow. I promise. You'll be all right. Cook knows her remedies." I nod, unsure if I should thank him, still waiting for him to reveal his true purpose for helping me. But he doesn't say anything else, apparently satisfied with my response. He stuffs his hands in his pockets and walks out the back door. Cook rustles around the cabinets, and a few minutes later, a mug of steaming tea is in my hands. After I drink it down, she sits in front of me, her scars inches from my face. I gaze at them, but they no longer seem grotesque. Is it because I've gotten used to seeing them, or because I have a disfigurement of my own? "Who's starring?" Cook asks. Her sapphire eyes glint, and for a moment they are hauntingly familiar. "You called for him in the night." The tea takes the edge off my dizziness, and I sit up. "He's my brother." "I see." Cook drips tanroot oil on a square of gauze and dabs it onto the wound. I wince in pain and grip the seat. "And is he in the resistance too?" "How could you?" "How could you know that?" I almost say, but then I recover my wits and press my lips together. Cook catches a slip and pounces. "It's not hard to tell. I've seen 100 slaves come and go. Resistance fighters are always different. Never broken. At least not when they first arrive. They have hope." She curls her lip as if she's speaking of a colony of diseased criminals instead of her own people. "I'm not with the rebels." I wish I hadn't spoken. Darren says my voice goes high when I lie, and Cook seems like the type to notice. Sure enough, her eyes narrow. "I'm not a fool, girl. Do you have any idea what you're doing? The commandant will find you out. She'll torture you, kill you. Then she'll punish anyone she thinks you were friends with. That means is... kitchen girl." "I'm not doing anything wrong. There was a woman once," she interrupts me abruptly. "Joined the resistance, learned to mix powders and potions so that the very air would turn to fire and stones to sand. But she got in over her head, did things for the rebels, horrible things that she never dreamt she'd do. Commandant caught her like she'd caught so many others. Carved her up good and ruined her face. Made her swallow
hot coals and ruined her voice. Then she made the woman a slave in her house. But not before killing everyone the woman knew. Everyone she loved. No, no. The source of Cook's scars becomes sickeningly clear. She nods, grimly acknowledging the dawning horror on my face. I lost everything. My family, my freedom. All for a cause that never had any hope to begin with. But before you came here, the Resistance sent a boy. Zane. He was supposed to be a gardener. Did they tell you about him? I almost shake my head but stop, crossing my arms instead. She doesn't acknowledge my silence. She's not guessing about me. She knows. It was 2 years ago. Commandant caught him. Tortured him in the school's dungeon for days. Some nights we could hear him screaming. When she was done with Zane, she gathered every last slave in Blackcliff. She wanted to know who'd been friends with him. Wanted to teach us a lesson for not turning in a traitor. Cook's eyes are fixed on me, unrelenting. Killed 3 slaves before she was satisfied that the message had sunk in. Lucky I'd warned Izzy away from the boy. Lucky she listened. Cook gathers her supplies and shoves them back into a cabinet. She picks up a cleaver and hacks at a bloody slab of meat waiting on the work table. I don't know why you ran away from your family to join those rebel bastards. She flings the words at me like stones. I don't care. Tell them you quit. Ask for another mission, somewhere where you won't hurt anyone. Because if you don't, you'll die. And Skies only knows what will happen to the rest of us. She points the cleaver at me, and I shift back in my chair, watching the knife. Is that what you want? She says. Death? Izzy? Tortured? She leans forward, spittle flying from her mouth. The knife is inches from my face. Is it? I didn't run away, I burst out. Pop's body, Nan's glazed irises, Darin's flailing limbs all flash before my eyes. I didn't even want to join. My grandparents, a mask came. I bite my tongue. Shut it, liar. I scowl at the old woman, unsurprised to see her glaring back. Tell me the truth about why you joined the rebels, she says, and I'll keep my mouth shut about your dirty little secret. Ignore me. And I'll tell that ice-hearted vulture upstairs exactly what you are. She drives a cleaver into the work table and drops into the seat next to me, waiting. Damn her. If I tell her about the raid and what came after, she might still rat me out. But if I say nothing, I have no doubt that she'll march to the Commandant's room this instant. She's just insane enough to do it. I have no choice. As I speak of what happened that night, she remains silent and unmoved. When I finish, my eyes are swollen, but Cook's mangled face reveals nothing. I wipe my face on my sleeve. Darin stuck in prison. It's only a matter of time before they torture him to death or sell him as a slave. I have to get him out before then, but I can't do it alone. The rebels said if I spied for them, they'd help me. I stand, shakily. You could threaten to turn my soul over to the Nightbringer himself. Doesn't matter. Darin's my only family. I have to save him. Cook says nothing. And after a minute passes, I assume she's chosen to ignore me. Then, as I move to the door, she speaks. Your mother. Mira? At the sound of mother's name, I jerk my head around. Cook is examining me. You don't look like her. I'm so surprised I don't bother to deny it. Cook has to be in her 70s. She'd have been in her 60s when my parents controlled the Resistance. What was her real name? What had her role been? You knew my mother? Knew her? Yes, I knew her. Always liked you, your father better. She clears her throat and shakes her head in irritation. Strange. I've never heard her stutter. Kind man. Smart man. Not like your mother. My mother was the lioness. Your mother isn't worth your words. Cook's voice drops into a snarl. Never, never listens to anything but her own selfishness. The lioness. Her mouth twists around the name. She's the reason I'm here. Her breath heaves now, as if she's having some sort of fit. But she barrels on, determined to get out whatever it is she wishes to say. The lioness, the resistance, and their grand plans. Traitors, liars, fools. She stands and reaches for her cleaver. Don't trust them. I don't have a choice, I say. I have to. They'll use you. Her hands shake, and she grips the counter. She gasps out the last few words. They take, and then they'll throw you to the wolves. I warned you, remember? I warned you.
Chapter 22. Elias. At exactly midnight, I return to Blackcliff in full battle armor, dripping with weaponry. After the trial of courage, I'm not about to be caught shoeless with only a dagger for defense. Though I'm desperate to know if Hel is all right, I resist the urge to go to the infirmary. Cain's orders to stay away didn't leave room for argument. As I stalk past the gate guards, I fervently hope not to run into my mother. I think I'd snap at the sight of her, especially knowing that her scheming nearly killed Helene, and especially after seeing what she'd done to the slave girl this morning. When I'd seen the K carved into the girl, Lyre, I'd flexed my fists, imagining, for one glorious moment, the feel of inflicting such pain on the Commandant. See how she likes it, the hag. At the same time, I wanted to back away from Lyre in shame, because the woman who'd done such evil shares my blood. She is half of me. My own reaction, that ravenous lust for violence, is proof. I'm not like her. Or am I? I think back to the nightmare battlefield. 539 bodies. Even the Commandant would be hard-pressed to take so many lives. If the augurs are right, I'm not like my mother. I'm worse.
You will become everything you hate,
Cain had said when I'd considered deserting. But how could leaving my mask behind make me any worse of a person than the one I saw on that battlefield? Lost in my thoughts, I don't notice anything unusual about Skull's quarters when I arrive at my room. But after a moment, it sinks in. Leander's not snoring, and Demetrius isn't mumbling his brother's name. Faris's door isn't open, as it almost always is. The barracks are abandoned. I draw my Sims. The only sound is the occasional pop of the oil lamps flickering against the black brick. Then, one by one, the lamps go out. Grey smoke seeps beneath the door at one end of the hall, expanding like a roiling bank of storm cloud. In an instant, I realize what's happening. The second trial, the trial of cunning, has begun.
Watch out!
A voice shouts from behind me. Helene, alive, shoves through the doors at my back, fully armed and without a hair out of place. I want to tackle her in a hug, but instead I drop to the floor as a volley of razor-edged throwing stars hurtles through the space where my neck was. The stars are followed by a trio of attackers who spring from the smoke like coiled snakes. They are lithe and quick, their bodies and faces wrapped in funereal strips of black cloth. Almost before I'm on my feet, One of the assassins has a sim at my throat. I spin back and kick his feet out from under him, but my leg meets only air. Strange. He was there, just now. At my side, Helene's sim flashes swift as quicksilver as an assassin presses her toward the smoke.
Evening, Elias!
She calls over the clash of sims. She catches my eye, an irrepressible grin spreading across her face.
Miss me?
I don't have the breath to answer. The other two assassins come at me fast, and though I fight with both sims, I can't get the upper hand. My left sim finally hits its mark, sinking into the chest of my opponent. Bloodthirsty triumph surges through me. Then the attacker flickers and disappears. I freeze, doubting what I've seen. The other assassin takes advantage of my hesitation and shoves me back into the smoke. It's as if I've been dropped into the darkest, blackest cave in the Empire. I try to feel my way forward, but my limbs are leaden, and in moments I slip to the floor, my body a dead weight. A throwing star cuts through the air, and I barely register the fact that it has grazed my arm. My sims hit the stone of the hallway, and Helene screams. The sounds are muted, as if I'm hearing them through water.
Poison.
The word brings me out of my senselessness. The smoke is poisonous. With my last shreds of consciousness, I scour the ground for my sims and crawl out of the darkness. A few breaths of clean air help me reclaim my wits, and I notice that Helene has disappeared. As I search the smoke for any sign of her, an assassin emerges. I duck beneath his sim, intending to wrap my arms around his chest and slam him to the floor. But when my skin meets his, cold lances through me, and I gasp and jerk away. It feels as if I've dipped my arm into a bucket of snow. The assassin flickers and disappears, reappearing a few yards away.
They're not human, I realize.
Zack's warning echoes in my head.
The old creatures are real. They're coming for us.
10 burning hells, and I thought he had cracked. How is it possible? How could the augurs have...
The assassin circles me, and I shelve my questions. How this thing got here doesn't matter. How to kill it, that's a question worth answering. A flash of silver catches my eye. Helene's gauntleted hand clawing the floor as she tries to pull herself out of the smoke. I drag her out, but she's too bleary to stand. So I throw her over my shoulder and flee down the hall. When I'm well away, I dump her to the ground and turn to face the enemy. The three of them are on me at once, moving too fast for me to counter. Within half a minute, I have nicks all over my face and a gash in my left arm.
Aquila!
I holler. She staggers to her feet.
A little help, yeah?
She draws her sim and plunges into the fight, forcing two of the attackers to engage.
They're wraiths, Elias, she shouts. Bleeding, burning wraiths.
10 hells.
Masks train with sims and staffs and our bare hands, on horses and boats, blindfolded and chained, with no sleep, with no food. But we've never trained against something that isn't supposed to exist. What did that damn foretelling say? Cunning to outwit their foes. There's a way to kill these things. They must have a weakness. I just have to figure out what it is.
Lemmicles' offense.
Grandfather created the offense himself. A series of full-body attacks, allowing one to identify a combatant's deficiencies. I attack head, then legs, arms, and torso. A dagger I fling at the wraith's chest goes right through him, falling to the floor with a clatter. But he doesn't try to block the dagger. Instead, his hand flashes up to protect his throat. Behind me, Helene shouts for aid as the other two wraiths press the attack. One lifts a dagger high above her heart, but before it comes down, I whip my sim around and through his neck. The wraith's head plunges to the ground, and I grimace as an unearthly scream echoes in the hall. Seconds later, the head, and the body it goes with, disappears.
Watch your left!
Hell shouts. I sweep my sim in an arc to my left without looking. A hand closes on my wrist, and piercing cold numbs my arm to the shoulder. But then my sim strikes home. The hand is gone, and another eldritch scream pierces the air. The assault slows as the last wraith circles us.
You really should run,
Helene says to the creature.
You're just going to die.
The wraith looks between us and sets upon Helene.
They always underestimate me.
Even wraiths, apparently. She ducks beneath his arm, light-footed as a dancer, and takes off his head with one clean stroke. The wraith vanishes, the smoke dissipates, and the barracks go still, as if the last 15 minutes never happened.
Well, that was...
Helene's eyes go wide, and I lunge to one side without needing to be told, turning just in time to see a knife hurtling through the air. It misses me, barely, and Helene is past me in a blur of blonde and silver.
Marcus,
she says.
I'm on him.
Wait, you idiot! It might be a trap! But the door is already swinging shut behind her, and I hear the crash of sim striking sim, followed by the crunch of bone beneath fist. I burst from the barracks to see Helene advancing on Marcus, who has a hand to his bloodied nose. Helene's eyes are ferocious slits, and for the first time, I see her as others must. Deadly, remorseless, a mask. Though I want to help her, I hold back, scanning the darkened grounds around us. If Marcus is here, Zack won't be far.
All healed up, Aquila!
Marcus faints left with his sim, and when Helene counters, he grins.
You and I have some unfinished business.
His eyes inch over her form.
You know what I've always wondered? If raping you will be like fighting you. All those lean muscles, that pent-up energy.
Helene delivers a roundhouse that leaves Marcus on his back, with blood pouring from his mouth. She stamps on his sword arm and presses her sim point to his throat.
You filthy son of a whore!
She spits at him.
Just because you've got one lucky swipe in the forest doesn't mean I can't still gut you with my eyes closed.
But Marcus gives her a vicious smile, unfazed by the steel digging into his throat.
You're mine, Aquila. You belong to me, and we both know it. The augurs told me. Save yourself the trouble and join me now.
The blood drains from Helene's face. There's black, hopeless rage in her eyes, the type of anger you feel when your hands are tied and there's a knife at your jugular. Only Helene is the one holding the blade. What in the skies is wrong with her?
Never.
The tone of her voice doesn't match the strength of the sim in her fist, and, as if she knows it, her hand shakes.
Never, Marcus.
A flicker in the shadows beyond the barracks catches my eyes. I'm halfway there when I see Zack's light brown hair and the flash of an arrow cutting through the air.
Drop, Hell!
She plunges to the ground, the arrow sailing harmlessly over her shoulder. I know instantly that she was never in any danger, at least not from Zack. Not even a one-eyed yearling with a lame arm would miss a shot that easy. The brief distraction is all Marcus needs. I expect him to attack Hell, but he rolls away and flees into the night, still grinning, Zack close behind.
What the hell was that?
I bellow at Helene.
You could have cut him open and you choke. What was that rubbish he was spouting? Now's not the time.
Helene's voice is tight.
We need to get out of the open. The augurs are trying to kill us.
Tell me something I don't know.
No, that's the second trial, Elias. Them actively trying to assassinate us.
Cain told me after he healed me. The trial will last until dawn. We have to be clever enough to avoid our murderers, whoever or whatever they might be.
Then we need a base, I say. Out here, anyone can pick us off with an arrow. There's no visibility in the catacombs, and the barracks are too cramped.
There!
Hel points to the eastern watchtower, which overlooks the dunes.
The legionnaires manning it can set a guard at the entrance, and it's a good fighting space.
We make for the tower, sticking close to the walls in the shadows. At this hour, there isn't a single student or centurion out. Silence hangs over Blackcliff, and my voice seems inordinately loud. I lower it to a whisper.
I'm glad you're all right. Worried, were you?
Of course I was worried. I thought you were dead. If something had happened to you... It doesn't bear thinking about. I look Helene square in the face, but she only meets my gaze for a second before flicking her eyes away.
Yes, well, you should have been worried. I heard you dragged me to the bell tower covered in blood.
I did. Wasn't pleasant. You stank, for one.
I owe you, Vittorius.
Her eyes soften, and the steely, Blackcliff-trained part of me shakes its head. She can't turn into a girl on me now.
Cain told me everything you did for me, from the second Marcus attacked. And I want you to know...
You'd have done the same. I cut her off gruffly, satisfied by the stiffening of her body, the ice in her eyes. Better ice than warmth, better strength than weakness. Unspoken things have arisen between Helene and me, things that have to do with how I feel when I see her bare skin, and her awkwardness when I tell her I worry for her. After so many years of straightforward friendship, I don't know what these things mean, but I do know that now's not the time to think about them, not if we want to survive the second trial. She must get it. She gestures for me to take point, and we don't speak as we head to the watchtower. When we reach its base, I allow myself to relax for a second. The tower sits at the edge of the cliffs and overlooks the dunes to the east and the school to the west. Blackcliff's watch wall extends north and south. Once we're at the top, we'll see any threat long before it reaches us. But when we're halfway up the tower's inner stairs, Helene slows behind me.
Elias?
The warning in her voice has me drawing both of my sims. The only thing that saves me. A shout sounds from below us, another from above, and suddenly the stairwell echoes with the ping of arrows and the shuffle of boots. A squad of legionnaires pours down the stairs, and for a second I'm confused. Then they're on me.
Legionnaires!
Helene shouts.
Stand down! Stand!
I want to tell her to save her breath. No doubt the augurs told the legionnaires that for this night we are enemies, and they are to kill us on sight. Damn it! Cunning to outwit their foes. We should have realized that anyone, everyone, could be an enemy.
Back to back, Hel!
Her back is to mine in an instant. I cross sims with the soldiers coming down from the top of the tower, while she battles those heading up from the base. My battle rage surges, but I rein it in, fighting to wound, not kill. I know some of these men. I can't just butcher them.
Damn it, Elias!
Hel screams. One of the legionnaires I've slashed pushes down past me and marks Hel's sword arm.
Fight! They're marshals, not turntail barbarian rabble.
Hel's fighting off three soldiers below her and two above, with more coming. I have to clear the stairs so we can make it to the top of the tower. It's the only way we'll avoid death by skewering. I let the battle rage take me and surge up the stairs, sims flying. One cuts into the gut of a legionnaire, the other slides across a throat. The stairwell isn't wide enough for two sims, so I sheath one and pull out my dagger, driving it into the kidney of a third soldier and the heart of a fourth. In seconds,
The way above is clear, and Helene and I race up the stairs. We get to the top of the watchtower, only to find more soldiers waiting. Are you going to kill them all, Elias? How many added to your tally? 4 already? 10 more? 15? Just like your mother. Fast as her. Ruthless as her. My body freezes as it never has in battle, my foolish heart taking control. Helene shouts, spins, kills, defends, while I stand there. Then it's too late to fight, because a jut-jawed brute with arms like tree trunks tackles me.
Veturius! Helene says. More soldiers coming from the north!
Mrvah!
The big orc has my face smashed against the side of the watchtower, his hands so tight around my skull that I'm sure he means to crush it. He uses his knee to pin me, and I can't budge an inch. For a moment, I admire his technique. He recognizes that he can't counter my fighting skills, and has instead used surprise and his colossal bulk to best me. My admiration fizzles as stars burst before my eyes.
Cunning! You have to use cunning!
But the time for cunning is past. I shouldn't have gotten distracted. I should have run a sim through the orc's chest before he ever got to me. Helene darts away from her attackers to help me, pulling on my belt as if to yank me away from the giant soldier, but he pushes her away. The orc slides me along the wall to a niche in the battlements and shoves me through, holding me by my neck above the dunes like a child with a rag doll. 600 feet of hungry air grasps at my legs. Behind my captor, a sea of legionnaires tries to pull Helene down, barely keeping a hold on her as she twists and spits, a cat in a net.
Always victorious!
Grandfather's voice echoes in my head.
Always victorious!
I dig my fingers into the tendons of the brute's arms, trying to work myself free.
I bet 10 marks on you.
The orc appears genuinely pained.
But orders are orders.
Then he opens his hand and lets me fall. The fall lasts an eternity and no time at all. My heart shoots into my throat, my stomach plunges, and then, with a jerk that rattles my skull, I'm not falling anymore. But I'm not dead either. My body dangles, tethered by a rope hooked to my belt. Helene had yanked on my belt. She must have attached the rope then. Which means she is on the other end. Which means if the soldiers throw her over, and I'm still dangling like a comatose spider, we'll both fall hard and fast to the hereafter. I swing toward the cliff face and scrabble for a handhold. The rope is 30 feet long, and this close to the base of the watchtower, the cliffs aren't as sheer. A granite shelf juts out from a fissure a few feet away. I wedge myself in tightly, and only just in time. A shriek echoes from above me, followed by a tumble of blonde and silver. I brace my legs and pull in the rope as fast as I can, but I am still nearly yanked off the rock shelf by the force of Helene's weight.
I've got you, Hel!
I shout, knowing how terrified she must be hanging hundreds of feet in the air like this.
Hold on!
When I pull her into the fissure, she is wild-eyed and shaking. There is hardly room for both of us on the shelf, and she grabs my shoulders to anchor herself.
It's all right, Hel.
I tap the ledge with a boot.
See? Solid rock beneath us.
She nods into my shoulder, clinging to me in a most un-Helene-like way. Even through our armor, I feel her curves. My stomach leaps strangely. She fidgets, which really doesn't help things, seemingly as aware as I of the closeness of our bodies. My face grows hot at the sudden tension between us.
Focus, Elias.
I pull away from her as an arrow thunks into the rock beside us. We've been spotted.
We're easy pickings on this ledge, I say. Here.
I unknot the cord from my belt and hers, and stuff it into her hands. Tie this to an arrow. Make it tight. She does as I ask, while I grab a bow from my back and scan the cliffs for a harness. One dangles 15 feet away. It's a shot I could make with my eyes closed, except that the legionnaires are hauling the harness back up the cliff face and into the tower. Helene hands me the arrow, and before more missiles come hurtling from above, I lift my bow, notch the arrow, shoot, and miss. Damn it! The legionnaires pull the harness just out of range. They yank up the other harnesses along the cliff, strap themselves in, and begin rappelling down.
Elias!
Helene nearly flings herself off the ledge, trying to avoid an arrow, grabbing onto my arm.
We have to get out of here!
I figured that out, thanks. I barely dodge an arrow myself. If you've got a genius plan, I'm open to ideas. Helene grabs the bow from me, takes aim with the corded arrow, and a second later, one of the legionnaires rappelling down goes limp. She pulls the body over and unbuckles him from the harness. I try to ignore the distant thump of the soldier's body hitting the dunes. Hel frees the cord while I grab the harness and strap myself in. I'll have to carry her down.
Elias,
she whispers when she realizes what we have to do.
I can't.
You can. I won't let you fall. I promise. I test the harness anchor with a sharp yank, hoping it will hold the weight of 2 fully armed masks. Climb onto my back. I take her chin and force her to meet my eyes. Rope us together like before. Wrap your legs around my waist. Don't let go until we hit the sand. She does as I ask, and ducks her head into my neck as I leap off the edge, her breath coming short and fast.
Don't fall. Don't fall,
I hear her muttering.
Don't fall, don't.
Arrows streak toward us from the tower, and the legionnaires have dropped level now. They draw sims and glide across the cliff face. My hand itches toward a weapon, but I resist. I have to keep hold of the ropes so we don't plummet to the desert floor.
Keep them off me, Hel!
Her legs tighten around my hips, and her bow twangs as she launches arrow after arrow into our pursuers. Thwunk, thwunk, thwunk. One howl of agony is joined by another and another as Helene draws and shoots, fast as lightning striking. The arrows from the tower thin as we drop, clattering off our armor uselessly. Every muscle in my arms strains to keep us dropping steadily. Almost there. Almost. Then a searing pain shoots through my left thigh. We slide 50 feet as I lose control of the descender. Helene grabs me as her head snaps back, and she screams, a girlish shriek I know I should never, ever mention.
Damn it, Vittorius!
Sorry, I grind out when I get hold of the ropes.
I'm hit. They still coming. No.
Helene cranes her neck back and stares up the sheer cliff face.
They're going back up.
The hairs on the back of my neck rise in warning. There's no reason for the soldiers to stop the attack. Not unless they think someone else will take over for them. I peer down at the dunes, still 200 feet below us. I can't tell if there's anyone down there. A gust of wind blows out of the desert, knocking us hard against the cliff face, and I almost lose control of the ropes again. Helene yelps, her arm tense around me. My leg burns with pain, but I ignore it. It's just a flesh wound. For a second, I think I hear a peal of deep, mocking laughter.
Elias!
Helene looks out at the desert, and I know what she's going to say before she says it.
There's something...
The wind steals the words from her mouth, sweeping out of the dunes with unnatural fury. I release the descender, and we drop, but not fast enough. A violent gust rips my hands from the ropes, halting our descent. Sand from the dunes rises in a funnel around us. Before my disbelieving eyes, the particles weaved together, coalescing into large, man-like shapes with grasping hands and holds for eyes.
What are they?
Helene slashes the air uselessly with her sim, her strokes increasingly uncontrolled. Not human and not friendly. The augurs have already unleashed one supernatural terror on us. It isn't much of a stretch to assume that they'd trot out another. I reach for the ropes, now hopelessly tangled. The pain in my thigh explodes, and I look down to see the arrow being slowly pulled through my flesh by a sandy hand. The laughter echoes again as I hurriedly break off the arrowhead. I'll be crippled for life if it's dragged through my leg. Sand buffets my face, biting at my skin, before solidifying into another creature. This one looms over us, a miniature mountain, and although his features are poorly defined, I can still make out his wolf's smile. I smother my disbelief and try to think back to Mamie Reela's stories. We've already dealt with wraiths, and this thing is big, not like a wight or a ghoul. Ifrits are supposed to be shy, but djinn are vicious and cunning.
It's a djinn!
I shout over the wind. The sand creature laughs as delightedly as if I'm juggling and pulling faces.
Djinn are dead, little aspirant.
His screams are like a wind out of the north. Then he swoops in close, eyes narrowing. His other brethren form up behind him, dancing and somersaulting with the zeal of acrobats at a carnival.
Destroyed by your kind long ago, in a great war. I am Rowan Goldgale, king of the Sand Ifrits. I will claim your souls as mine.
Why would a king of Ifrits concern himself with mere humans?
Helene plays for time, as I frantically untangle the ropes and straighten the descender.
Mere humans!
The Ifrits behind the king hoot with laughter.
You are aspirants. Your footsteps echo in the sand and the stars. To own souls such as yours is a great honor. You will serve me well.
What's he talking about?
Helene asks me in an undertone.
No idea, I say. Keep him distracted.
Why enslave us?
Helene asks.
When we would, serve you willingly.
Stupid girl! In these sacks of flesh, your souls are useless. I must awaken and tame them. Only then can you serve me. Only then.
His voice is lost in a whoosh of wind as we drop away. The Ifrits shriek and streak after us, surrounding and blinding us, tearing my hands from the ropes once more.
Take them!
Rowan bays at his cohort. Helene's grip on me loosens as an Ifrit works his way between us. Another pries the sim from her hand and the bow from her back, shrieking in elation as the weapons drop to the dunes. Yet another Ifrit soars at our rope with a sharp rock. I draw my sim and shove it through the creature, twisting, hoping steel will kill the thing. The Ifrit howls. In pain or anger, I can't tell. I try to take off its head, but it flits up out of reach, cackling nastily.
Think, Elias.
The shadow assassins had a weakness. The Ifrits must too. Mamie Reela told tales about them. I know she did. But I can't bleeding remember any of them.
Ah!
Helene's arms jerk free of me, and she holds on with only her legs. The Ifrits ululate, doubling their efforts to pull her away. Rowan puts his hands on either side of her face and squeezes, imbuing her with an otherworldly gold light.
Mine!
The Ifrit says.
Mine! Mine! Mine!
The rope frays. Blood pours from the wound on my thigh. The Ifrits rip Helene away, and as they do, I spot a niche in the cliff that runs all the way down to the desert floor. Mamie Reela's face appears in my head, illuminated by the campfire as she chants.
Efreet of the wind, kill him with a star-steel pin. Efreet of the sea, light a fire to make him flee. Efreet of the sand, a song is more than he can stand.
I hurl my sim up at the Efreet soaring at the ropes and swing forward, plucking Helene from the grip of the Efreets and shoving her into the niche, all the while ignoring her yell of surprise and the angry, tearing hands at my back.
Sing, Hel! Sing!
She opens her mouth. To shout or sing, I don't know, because the rope finally gives way and I plummet. Helene's pale face fades away above me. Then the world goes quiet and white, and I know no more.
Chapter 23. Liar. Izzy finds me after I leave the kitchen, still shaken by Cook's warning. The girl offers me a sheaf of papers, the Commandant's specs for Telemann. I offered to take them, she says, but she didn't like that idea. No one pays me heed as I make my way through Sarah to Telemann's forge. No one can see the raw, bloody K beneath the cloak I wear. As I stumble along, it's clear I'm not the only injured slave. Some scholar slaves have bruises, some have whip marks. Others walk as if injured inside, hunched and limping. While still in the Illustrian quarter, I pass a large glass display of saddles and bridles and stop short, startled at my own reflection, at the haunted, hollow-eyed creature looking back at me. Sweat soaks my skin, half from fever, half from the unabating heat. My dress clings to my body, my skirt bunching and tangling around my legs. It's for Darin, I keep walking. Whatever you're suffering, he's suffering worse. As I near the weapons quarter, my feet slow. I remember the Commandant's words from last night. You're lucky I want a Telemann blade, girl. You're lucky he wants a taste of you. I loiter near the smithy door for long minutes before entering. Surely Telemann won't want to come near me when my skin is the colour of whey and I'm sweating buckets. The shop is as quiet as it was the first time I visited, but the smith is here. I know it. Sure enough, within seconds of me opening the door, I hear the whisper of footsteps and Telemann appears from the back room. He takes one look at me and disappears, returning seconds later with a dripping glass of cool water and a chair. I drop into the seat and drain the water, not stopping to consider if it might be poisoned. The forge is cool, the water cooler, and for a second my fevered shaking slows. Then Spiro Telemann slips past me to the forge door. He locks it. Slowly I stand, holding the glass out like an offering, like a trade, like I'll give him his glass back and he'll unlock the door and let me go without hurting me. He takes it from my hand, and I wish then that I'd kept it, broken it, to use as a weapon. He looks into the glass.
Who did you see when the ghouls came?
The question is so unexpected that I'm startled into the truth. I saw my brother. The smith scrutinizes my face, his brow furrowed as if he's considering something, making a decision.
You're his sister, then, he says. Liar. Darin spoke of you often.
He spoke? Why would Darin speak to this man about me? Why would he speak to this man at all?
Strangest thing. Telemann leans back against the counter. The Empire tried forcing apprentices on me for years, but I didn't find one until I caught Darin spying on me from up there.
The shutters on the high bank of windows are open, revealing the crate-littered balcony of the building next door.
Dragged him down. Thought I'd haul him to the oxes. Then I saw his sketchbook.
He shakes his head, not needing to explain. Darin put so much life into his drawings that it seemed if you just reached out, you could pull them from the page. He wasn't just drawing the inside of my forge. He was designing the weapons themselves. Such things I'd only seen in dreams. I offered him the apprentice spot there and then, thinking he'd run, that I'd never see him again. But he didn't run, I whisper. He wouldn't run. Not Darin. No. He came into the forge, looked around. Cautious, yes, not afraid. I never saw your brother afraid. He felt fear. I'm sure he did. But he never seemed to focus on what could turn out wrong. He only ever thought about how things could turn out right. The Empire thought he was resistance, I say. All this time, he was working for the Marshals. If that's true, why is he still in jail? Why haven't you gotten him out? Do you think the Empire would allow a scholar to learn their secrets? He wasn't working for the Empire. He was working for me. And I parted ways with the Empire a long time ago. I do enough for them to keep them off my back. Armor mostly, until Darin came. I hadn't made a true Tullaman Sim for 7 years. But his sketchbook had pictures of swords. That damn sketchbook, Spiro snorts. I told him to keep it here, but he wouldn't listen. Now the Empire has it, and there's no getting it back.
He wrote down formulas in it, I say. Instructions. Things he shouldn't have known.
He was my apprentice. I taught him to make weapons. Fine weapons. Tullaman weapons. But not for the Empire.
I swallow nervously as the implications of his words sink in. No matter how clever scholar uprisings have been, in the end it comes down to steel against steel. And in that battle, the Marshals always win. You wanted him to make weapons for the scholars. That would be treason. When Spiro nods, I can't believe him. This is a trick, like with Veturius this morning. It's something Tullaman's planned with the Commandant to test my loyalty. If you'd really been working with my brother, someone would have seen. Other people must work here, slaves, assistants.
I'm the Tullaman Smith. Other than my apprentice, I work alone, as my forefathers did. It's the reason your brother and I were never caught. I want to help Darin, but I can't. The mask who took Darin recognized my work in his sketches. I've been questioned about it twice already. If the Empire learns I took your brother as my apprentice, they'll kill him. Then they'll kill me, and right now I'm the only chance the scholars have at casting off their chains.
Were you working with the Resistance?
No, Spiro says. Darin didn't trust them. He tried to stay away from the fighters. But he used the tunnels to get here, and a few weeks ago, two rebels spotted him leaving the weapons quarter. Thought he was a Marshal collaborator. He had to show them his sketchbook to keep them from killing him. Spiro sighs. Then, of course, they wanted him to join up. Wouldn't leave him alone. Lucky in the end. That connection to the Resistance is the only reason either of us is still alive. As long as the Empire thinks he's holding rebel secrets, they'll keep him in prison.
But he told them he wasn't with the Resistance, I say. When the Mask raided us...
Stock answer. Empire expects real rebels to deny membership for days, weeks even, before giving in. We prepared for this. I taught him how to survive interrogation and prison. As long as he stays here in Sarah and out of Koff, he should be fine.
For how long, I wonder? I'm afraid to cut Tullaman off, but I'm more afraid not to. If he's telling the truth, then the more of this I listen to, the more danger I'm in. The Commandant's expecting a reply. She'll send me back for it in a few days. Here.
Liar. Wait. but I shove the papers in his hands, dart to the door, and unlock it. He can easily come after me, but he doesn't. Instead, he watches as I hurry down the alley. When I turn the corner, I think I hear him curse. At night, I toss restlessly in the tiny box that is my room, the rope of my pallet digging into my back, the roof and walls so close that I can't breathe. My wound burns, and my mind echoes with Tullamon's words. Serik Steel is the heart of the Empire's strength. No marshal would give up its secrets to a scholar. And yet, something about Tullamon's claims rings true. When he spoke of Darin, he captured my brother perfectly. His drawings, the way he thinks. And Darin, like Spiro, told me he wasn't with the marshals or the resistance. It all aligns. Except the Darin I knew wasn't interested in rebellion. Or was he? Memories cascade through my head. Darin's silence when Pop told us of how he set the bones of a child beaten by oxes. Darin excusing himself when Nan and Pop discussed the most recent martial raids. Fists clenched. Darin ignoring us to draw scholar women flinching from masks and children fighting over a rotted apple in the gutter. I thought my brother's silence meant he was pulling away from us. But maybe silence was his solace. Maybe it was the only way he could fight his outrage at what was happening to his people. When I do fall asleep, Cook's warning about the resistance burrows its way into my dreams. I see the Commandant cut me over and over. Each time her face changes from Mazin's to Keenan's to Tullamon's to Cook's. I wake to choking darkness and gasp for breath, trying to push away the walls of my quarters. I scramble out of my bed, through the open-air corridor and into the back courtyard, guzzling the cool night breezes. It's past midnight, and clouds scud over a nearly full moon. In a few days, it'll be time for the Moon Festival, the scholars' midsummer celebration of the largest moon of the year. Nan and I were supposed to hand out cakes and pastries this year. Darin was supposed to dance until his feet fell off. In the moonlight, the forbidding buildings of Black Cliff are almost beautiful. The sable granite softened to blue. The school is, as always, eerily hushed. I never feared the night, not even as a child. But Black Cliff's night is different, heavy with a silence that makes you look over your shoulder. A silence that feels like a living thing. I look up at the stars hanging low in a sky that makes me think I'm seeing the infinite. But beneath their cold gaze, I feel small. All the beauty of the stars means nothing when life here on Earth is so ugly. I didn't used to think so. Darin and I spent countless nights on the roof of our grandparents' house, tracing the path of the great river, the archer, the swordsman. We'd watch for falling stars, and whoever saw one first would issue a dare. Since Darin's eyes were sharp as a cat's, I was always the one stuck stealing apricots from the neighbours or pouring cold water down the back of Nan's shirt. Darin can't see the stars now. He's stuck in a cell block, lost in the labyrinth of Sarah's prisons.